Welcome to the Diabetes Podcast. Have you ever felt like you know what to do, but just can't seem to do it? You're hungry when you shouldn't be. You're tired even when you sleep. And your cravings override your best intentions? What if I told you it might not be about willpower at all, but about how your brain responds to insulin? Today we're shining light on one of the most overlooked drivers for cravings, foggy thinking, and the inability to stick with healthy habits. Brain insulin resistance. If you've ever felt like your body's doing one thing and your brain is doing another, this episode is for you. Because the truth is, your brain may be sending out the wrong signals. Let's talk about why that matters and what you can do to reclaim your energy, memory, and satiety. Let's get into it. Hello, I'm Richie.
And I'm Amber.
And Amber, today we're talking about brain insulin resistance.
Yes,
so
we are.
I think it would be useful to, up to this point in time, we've been talking about how insulin is signaling throughout my body to get sugar out of the bloodstream into the cells. I'm guessing that insulin's maybe doing some other stuff inside the brain. And can you talk to us about what insulin does in a normal, healthy brain?
Oh, that's a loaded question. Insulin does a lot of things in a healthy brain. And when your brain stops responding to insulin, as it does in brain insulin resistance, it throws off your neurotransmitters first and foremost. So those are the brain's chemical messengers. And throughout this process of speaking about insulin resistance, we've talked about disrupted communication first and foremost. So this is really no different at its core level. It's the brain's chemical messengers. So things that control your mood, your motivation, your cravings for food, and even energy regulation, those are getting disrupted. So as we really dive into a discussion about insulin resistance and the brain, the really important distinction to make is that your brain does not need insulin to get glucose. So everything we've talked about up until this point has been a problem with insulin not being able to get into the muscle cell, the liver cell, the fat cell. It's been a problem of insulin resistance at the level of the cell. But this is different. Mm-hmm. This is all of the other brain processes that insulin controls. So unlike muscle and fat cells that require insulin to let glucose in through that insulin-dependent GLUT4 transporter chain, most of your brain cells use GLUT1 and GLUT3, which are insulin-independent. They do not need insulin. So that means even in the presence of severe insulin resistance, or even no insulin at all, like you might have in type 1 diabetes, the brain can still take in glucose.
Okay, so we talked about GLUT4 before. I'm a little confused. You said, because my understanding was prior to this, that GLUT4 could allow sugar to get into my cells even without insulin. Mm-hmm. And now you're telling me that GLUT4 is insulin dependent?
GLUT4 is insulin dependent. However, exercise changes the game. Exercise can override some of that. So GLUT4 is the primary glucose transporter in skeletal muscle, mm-hmm. your muscles, and fat tissue or adipose tissue. So under those normal conditions, insulin is the switch that triggers GLUT4 to move from inside the cell to the cell membrane, allowing glucose to enter. The key that unlocks the cell to let the glucose get in. But muscle contractions provide an insulin-independent pathway for GLUT4. So during physical activity, the muscle contractions themselves activate a different inside the cell signaling pathway. And that's what pushes that GLUT4 up to the cell surface. We talked a lot about that during the muscle insulin resistant podcast. So you can go back and catch that if you like. It's But that all happens without insulin or in the case of insulin resistance. So people with very low insulin levels, like type 1 or really strong insulin resistance, exercise is a way to allow muscles to take in glucose effectively because the brain runs on glucose. And really, that's like, I am not exaggerating there. The human brain, though only about 2% of our body by weight, uses around 20% of our energy needs at rest. And it strongly prefers glucose to meet that demand because it's just a faster energy source. It's really quick.
You said 20% mm-hmm. of my body's energy is used by my brain.
Well, not all people, but no, I'm just yes, 20% of your resting energy needs are, you know, of course, if you're exercising, if you're going for a run, you would have energy needs mm-hmm. from your muscles that are a larger percent of that expenditure. But at rest, it's your brain is really using the 20% of that energy okay. there. And what's fascinating is that most of the brain's glucose transport relies on that insulin independent, the GLUT1 and the GLUT3. And as we said before, that is to survive during times of famine, stress, or if someone's got that severe insulin resistance or even type 1, it's so crucial because the brain still needs glucose to function, period. And so adaptation assured that the brain could pull in glucose no matter what. And that's why it uses that insulin-independent GLUT1 and GLUT3 in the neurons. So I know we said it like two or three times at this point, but your brain does not need insulin to get glucose into the cells.
Okay. So if insulin isn't getting glucose into my brain, what's insulin doing?
Right. The issue is not the usual one that we've been talking to up until this point. So it's not about glucose transport, which is what we've been talking about. It's about insulin signaling within the neuron. So insulin plays this really critical role in so many things, like how the brain regulates appetite to really work on hunger and satiety, ghrelin and leptin in the brain, and it manages that signaling pathway, those neurotransmitters like dopamine and serotonin, and supports memory and cognitive function. It really modulates inflammation and protects the nerve cell. So insulin keeps your brain calm, focused, and the feeling of satiety, like feeling, oh, okay, we have that meal, we can chill and do other, fullness. And it helps you remember where you left your keys, you know, it helps with memory, of course. And it even balances your excitability and how calm you feel. Those kind of signals actually depend on insulin.
Okay. All right. So what is brain insulin resistance then? Because it's not, we've already established, it's not that the sugar's not getting in. What happened? Does my brain actually get resistant to insulin as well?
Yeah. Yeah. The fuel gets in. That's not a problem. Mm-hmm. It's more about the firing, what we call the synapses, that firing between the neurons. The brain kind of becomes deaf to insulin. It's firing, but it cannot hear it. And that's going to lead to the opposite of a lot of the things we talked about before. It's going to increase hunger and really severe cravings, like feeling hungry all the time, like just constantly. Have we eaten? Did we eat? What about food? Ooh, food. You know, it's like kind of this obsession over thoughts of food, which can lead to poor memory and poor attention and even accelerated brain aging. And mm-hmm. we can talk about that as we move along. But no matter, it's not about like if you've eaten enough food, you're still going to feel unsatisfied because there's this disconnect between what you've done and how the signaling that's going on. So you have this really broken hunger and satiety feedback loop. And that's the part at a biological level where Dr. Ralph DeFronzo included this in the Dirty Dozen as one of the core defects to what's going on with type 2 diabetes. But it's really not talked about fully, in my opinion.
You've got, obviously, way more experience in working with folks that have diabetes than I do. But I almost uniformly hear this narrative of, I'm just hungry all the time. I'm just constantly hungry. Is this what's causing that nonstop hunger?
Yep.
Okay. And
so the hypothalamus in your brain is very sensitive to insulin, and the satiety signal fails when the brain is insulin resistant and the cravings and the hunger cues increase, you know, and what's causing it are these chronically high insulin, chronically high blood sugar, systemic insulin resistance, high inflammation, high intake of saturated fat and processed foods, which actually creates inflammation in the hypothalamus itself. And you get this reduced insulin transport across the blood-brain barrier with sedentary behavior, poor sleep. You know, so lots of things. Rarely feel full, as we were saying before, just craving carbs, because your energy is because that signaling is not working appropriately. You can feel like you have brain fog.
Okay. Are there other signs of insulin resistance of the brain besides the constant hunger and the brain fog?
A lot of people report that they're struggling with sticking with health, like that there's a disconnect between what they want to do and the motivation and the drive to do, because this is also affecting your dopamine and that signaling pathway as well. So your motivation could be lacking. You could really be struggling to stick with healthy habits that you're like, I'm absolutely doing it. You've got this disconnect between intention and behavior.
So this is something where I think that very oftentimes the inability to stick to a diet or to stick to an exercise plan or something like that has a lot of shame attached to it. I should be better than this. I should be able to do this, all this other kind of stuff.
Shooting on yourself,
yeah,
I'd say.
Yeah. But this is sounding like I'm almost at a diminished brain capacity to adopt these, you know, healthy habits or whatever that may be.
Right. That is you are actually being sabotaged by this resistance that's going on. You know, it's even beyond how you're feeling and the hunger and satiety cues. Like, this insulin resistance blunts the antioxidant defenses in the brain, and you get these reactive oxygen species that accumulates. This is basically like your free radical damage, and it also leads to damage of the protective membrane around the neuron, and it can affect your DNA, crazy as it sounds, but it can affect the mitochondrial proteins, which accelerate aging and neurodegeneration. So that's one way that insulin resistance creates oxidative stress. And then that oxidative stress can lead to inflammation and microglia, which are the brain's immune cells. They can become chronically activated, and you get this persistent low-grade inflammatory state.
This is in my brain.
In your brain.
Okay.
Because we've talked about this around the visceral organs as well.
Right.
But this is specific to the brain. So it's interesting. You have a lot of the same things that are happening in the visceral spaces with chronic inflammation. It's and oxidative stress. It's just working on different cells and working in a different way, but it's still the same kind of core defect of inflammation and this oxidative stress. But when these brain's immune cells, when they become chronically elevated, you get this. This contributes to cognitive decline and even structural brain changes.
So how does that work?
Well, it reduces the white matter. It reduces the communication between the regions of the brain. It creates more of these amyloid proteins, which have been shown in Alzheimer's disease. So it just can affect a lot of these things.
So this is like structural changes in my brain due to insulin resistance?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Like if insulin can't act on that brain effectively, and tying it back to like what's doing it, high fat diets, chronic high insulin levels, that systemic inflammation, the brain is not immune to inflammation, just like any other part of your body. And eventually it can lead to death of the nerve cells, and like the nerve cells can die without that insulin saying, no, don't die, stay here. And like the neurons are more likely to undergo programmed cell death. And that's apoptosis, that they die prematurely. Mm-hmm. And as those changes accumulate over time, memory, attention, all those executive brain functions decline. And they're real hallmarks to both type 2 diabetes and the cognitive associative decline in Alzheimer's disease. It's quite frightening.
I know that diabetes increases the risk of Alzheimer's. Is this kind of the mechanism by which it does that? I'm not quite understanding that piece.
What I can say is that MRI images and PET imaging studies have shown that chronic inflammation and insulin resistance in the brain are very closely associated with cortical thinning. You have the cortex that goes around, and especially in the frontal and temporal lobes, reduced volume of the hippocampus, decreased integrity of the white matter in your brain. And it's this piece, increased amyloid plaque deposition. And then in Alzheimer's, they have these what's called tau tangles. And there's a, you know, there are a lot of similarities in what's shown in Alzheimer's and what's shown in sort of this cognitive decline that can show up in people who have type 2 diabetes. And even like if you go down the steps of, you know, the pathway towards diabetes, where it starts with high insulin levels, and then you have high post-meal blood sugars and then high fasting levels. When you get to the pre-diabetes state where you have the elevated fasting levels, that also correlates with atrophy and memory-related brain. So the regions of the brain that are responsible for memory have shrunk over time.
So this is, I mean, this is kind of jaw-dropping for me. Like when we're talking about structural changes in the brain, really what we're talking about is deformation, like the structural capacity of my brain, the portion that I rely on for how I interpret reality. You know, we talk about your cognition, my ability to take in sensory information and make sense of it. You know, my memory, my ability to recall that information. It, I mean, golly, like, you know, I thought thought this was just blood sugar. Now we're talking about like really, you know, the structural piece of my body that's most tied to, you know, me, you know, who I really am. That's now being affected by diabetes. That's something.
It is. It's having been in the space of diabetes education for 20 years, it's concerning to say the least. The number of people that I've had to teach how to use an insulin pen, how to draw up insulin via syringe, how to put on a continuous glucose monitor, how to wear an insulin delivery system. Like, to things that are really like complicated mm-hmm. to get in the beginning, but then once you do them a lot, they're easier, are quite overwhelming for a lot of people. And I've noticed a striking difference that not everyone's created equal. I could have a lot of trouble with someone who's 65, but has a lot more insulin resistance versus someone who's 85, but doesn't have a lot of insulin resistance. There are contrasts in teaching different people depending on what their cognitive impairment is at this stage of the game. And having to learn something new as and something as important as insulin and something as foreign a concept to some people because they don't understand.
They never thought about it. Yeah.
Yeah. What do you mean I have to inject this? Wait, I have to inject it 3-4 times a day, like at night in the morning? Like, when do I do this? Wait, I have to time it with my meal? What are you talking about? Carb counting? Like, it's just this spiral of overwhelm and in a brain that doesn't have the calming signals working appropriately. I've had many people break down and cry and be really overwhelmed at having to change their life in such a way in more advanced stages of, you know, requiring insulin and different things that happen. So it's important to know, like, insulin is not just a blood sugar hormone. It is brain preserving, to say the least. It is inflammation calming, and it makes sure you have energy and you feel like you have energy, not just eating, but feeling like you've eaten, because this is huge.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So are there medications I can do that help with the insulin resistance in the brain?
Yes. The strongest one, the one that really directly, because there your SGLT2s can have an indirect effect, but the one that is a really direct effect, one class is the GLP-1 receptor agonist. So they do target ghrelin and leptin in the brain, and they delay gastric emptying, which is sending the signal to the brain of satiety or fullness. And that's why people who start a GLP-1 receptor agonist, one thing I often hear is, I just don't think about food as much. Like, it was an ever-present, like, omnipresent, I am hungry, what's for dinner, what's to snack on all the time. And now they get a break. I think even Oprah said that, not to me, I wish. But, you know, that is something that is a very, very common report. But then you have to look at what happens at a year of somebody being on GLP-1s, because it is documented in study after study that somebody can have tremendous, excellent weight loss up until about a year. And these meds oftentimes will stop working as well, and the weight loss starts going back up near baseline. So it's thought that some insulin receptor desensitization may occur, or any kind of receptor, like whatever was helping with that hunger and satiety, the body is kind of overriding that. And also brain inflammation could persist if the person has not addressed the lifestyle factors that were creating the inflammation in the first place. And, you know, as with the receptor desensitization, the body is great at adapting. And the original drivers of that insulin resistance, poor sleep, chronic stress, inflammatory, high fat, high fructose corn syrup, high sugar diets, those can catch up. So, you know, this can be a fantastic tool, but it's not the whole answer.
Right. Okay. So if GLP-1s aren't the whole answer, is there anything meds can do that I can do better?
What is the answer, right? So it really starts with what you do every single day. That's what matters. Exercise. I feel like we always start there. Aerobic, resistance, exercise, these both can improve that signaling in the brain, the insulin signaling. And movement is always going to increase blood flow. And anytime you increase blood flow, you can reduce inflammation. And that also boosts neurogenesis, the making of new nerve cells. Really cool. And then in the nutrition aspect, which is always my favorite, again, high fiber. I think that has been listed on every single help for the nutrition side of the other core defects we've talked about. Anti-inflammatory diets. And when I say diet, I am talking about the food that goes into your mouth. That is your diet. Not a super restrictive chaos thing. I'm just talking about what you eat. That is your diet.
So we're not talking calories. We're talking types of foods that's going into my mouth. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. And a plant-based, plant at the forefront, star of the show, that kind of diet has been shown to reduce weight over time and reduce heart disease over time, like sustained across time. And it reduces insulin resistance, calms that inflammation that could we talked about occurring in the hypothalamus. And you could also time restrict your eating. So that could be as simple as I don't eat after 8 p.m. and I don't eat before 8 a.m., you know, depending on the person. But that can help with the circadian rhythms and ties into the fact that poor sleep increases cortisol and can disrupt the functioning of the insulin receptors in the brain. And also that chronic stress activates inflammatory pathways and worsens signaling. You can do meditation, breath work, working on your sleep hygiene, which is, you know, screens in bed are a no, getting to bed about the same time, waking up around the same time every day. These things really matter more than most people would believe to be true.
And we're probably going to end up doing a podcast on meditation, on breath work, on sleep hygiene at some point.
Certainly. So the big idea, you know, is to have the most energy, to have the best function possible, to really ensure your long-term brain health. You want to work on insulin resistance at all levels, because if you work on the insulin resistance in your body as a whole, that systemic inflammation, you're going to be working on your brain by default. And it's all a reversible process. So it's not just about healing your blood sugar, but healing your brain.
Okay. That was, once again, a lot.
A lot of good stuff.
A lot of good stuff. For me, really, that takeaway is anytime I'm talking cognitive dysfunction, anytime I'm talking a change in how I process information, a change in how I retain that. I mean, that's almost an attack on self, for me, anyway.
Right. You know? Your identity is, like most people use their brain.
Yeah.
I mean, most people are like, man, I was always good with numbers, or I could always remember what happened at this special event, and then they've lost it. Or I could always do my finances independently. That's a big one. And now I'm forgetting this and forgetting that. That really affects people. It really affects their feeling of freedom and independence. And
like I'm losing myself is really, you know, kind of for me, you know, we're not talking about my ankle doesn't work as good as it used to and that kind of stuff. We're really talking about, you know, physiologically who I am. Mm-hmm. That can be some scary stuff, but I am glad that seems like just like everything else. If I move a little better and if I eat a little better, I can actually positively affect my brain. I can help protect that. So that's some good stuff. Again, thanks for tuning in today. And
thank you. Yeah, we appreciate you.
We'll talk to you again next week. Thanks for tuning in today. this episode resonated with you, I invite you to share it with someone who might be struggling with cravings, fatigue, or brain fog. And if you're on your own journey to remission from type 2 diabetes, know this, the brain plays a bigger role than you think. Be sure to subscribe, leave a review, and if you need additional information or resources, check out empowereddiabetes.com. Until next time, stay empowered, stay curious, and keep taking steps to heal your body and your brain.